From Colorado Public Radio, this is Showcase. The recent mass shootings in Tucson, Newtown, and Aurora have rekindled the national debate over the causes of gun violence and how to best prevent these kinds of attacks from happening again. This week, a package of four gun control bills passed the State House and focused national attention on Colorado. Supporters say these bills will help keep guns and ammunition out of the hands of dangerous people, while opponents say they infringe on the Second Amendment and won't do anything to stop criminals from obtaining and using weapons. Against this background, the Counterterrorism Education Learning Lab, or CEL, in Denver, organized a panel, moderated by Governor John Hickenlooper, to discuss the various issues that are being debated around the country and around the state. This forum was held last Tuesday evening in the Sewell Ballroom in downtown Denver. The panel is made up of the following participants, in the order that you'll first hear them speak after Governor Hickenlooper's introduction. Tom DeLand is the chief of police for the city and county of Broomfield and currently serves as president of the Colorado Association of Chiefs of Police. State Representative Rhonda Fields is a Democrat from Aurora. She was a primary sponsor of two of the Colorado House bills, one that expands background checks to private party gun sales, and another that limits the number of rounds in a magazine clip to 15. State Senate President John Morse is a Democrat from Colorado Springs and a former paramedic and police officer. Representative Doug Lamborn is a Republican from Colorado Springs who represents Colorado's 5th Congressional District and is often cited as one of the most conservative members of Congress. Ken Buck is Weld County District Attorney and a former Republican candidate for U.S. Senate. And David Koppel is the research director at the Independence Institute, a libertarian think tank based in Golden. Governor Hickenlooper started the discussion with some opening remarks.
And I'm going to be very brief just because I want to make sure with 6 decidedly opinionated and informed and wise individuals that we are able to give them as much time as possible. I did want to frame the debate a little bit and talk just as it, we are in a different place in the West. Our heritage of guns is rich throughout the state's history, that pioneer spirit, gun ownership, the traditions around hunting. Over a third of the people in Colorado own at least one firearm. But at the same time, 2 of the worst shootings in history took place in Colorado. Every week there are roughly 10 gun deaths somewhere in Colorado. At issue here are the same challenges that are being faced by Congress at a national level. How do we respect the rights of law-abiding citizens to own their firearms while at the same time maintaining the health and safety of their communities? The tragedies at Columbine and Aurora really bring into sharp focus some of the differences in people's attitudes. And I think because of the horrific nature of those shootings, it's put Colorado at the front of this debate and makes all of us think a little more deeply about some of the attitudes and opinions we've had sometimes our entire lives, and do they need to change, or do we have to figure out a different way to talk about them? Today, I'm going to pose questions and have kind of facilitate a conversation. I'll be a moderator, more of a facilitator. Don't think Meet the Press. Think, you know, the Today Show. No, I'm just kidding. Then we will follow that with questions that we've been collecting from the audience, and certainly we look forward to a healthy and civilized debate. Okay, thank you. Short and sweet. So the first question I thought we'd just start and go around, and when we discuss this backstage, not everyone has to answer every question, and people can, you know, hopefully not interrupt too strongly, but facilitate a healthy discussion so that everyone gets a chance to talk about this. And I thought we'd start just briefly at the top. There's a real question, I think, that some people have been asking. Have we changed through time, and we have changed through time, our implementation of the Second Amendment? I mean, this is one of our constitutionally granted rights, and yet, for instance, that right now, sawed-off shotguns are illegal everywhere. Machine guns, you know, automatic weapons are illegal. Is this something that needs to be revisited, or is it have we reached some line that is sacrosanct? So just in a minute or two at the most, but each of you, give your opinion on that just from a philosophical point of view, and then we'll get down to more detailed questions. Why don't we start on the right?
Tom?
Governor, I represent the State Police Chiefs Association, and the views I express today will be based on the conversations that we've had over the last couple of months, and in fact had our annual conference recently, and had over 90 police chiefs from across the state, as well as a series of discussions by email. And how the police chiefs are viewing this issue across the state is one of community safety more than anything else. We realize that tonight we're here to talk about gun violence, but our role as police chiefs across the state is to provide for a safe community. And the bills that have been sponsored that we do support really are bills that we believe can make communities safer over time. There's a lot of other things that need to take place as well, and that's a discussion probably for another time. But as far as reviewing the Second Amendment, that's not something that the police chiefs have taken it upon themselves to do. We believe that as police chiefs and law enforcement officers, it's our duty to enforce the laws that are on the books. And really the issue about the Second Amendment is really left for others to decide, our elected officials, primarily in the courts. So, no, we have not taken that issue up, Governor.
Okay. Rhonda?
Thank you, Governor. And, you know, I just passed two bills that came out of the State House, and those bills did not infringe on the Second Amendment right. So the bill still will require those who want to own a gun, they can own a gun. And so it doesn't infringe at all. And we tried to make sure that we had a balanced approach when considering all the legislation. So I don't think we need to make any modifications to the Second Amendment. I believe in the Second Amendment, and the bills that have passed does not infringe on that right. It gives the person the right to bear arms and the right to defend themselves.
Thank you, Governor. And I agree with Rhonda. I think there's a balance here. There's always a balance. As the world moves forward, we have to rebalance constantly. You know, the Fourth Amendment concerning search and seizures, when that was written, there weren't automobiles. And so when we created automobiles and then they started being used in crimes, we had to figure out what's the balance between the right of privacy and the requirement for a search warrant and a motor vehicle, which wasn't even contemplated when the founders were crafting the Constitution. So I think that's the same thing with guns, and I think the Supreme Court, obviously, is the arbiter of what the Second Amendment means, and whether we agree with it or don't agree with it, that's the law of the land, as the Chief suggested, and it's what we have to implement. So I do think that all of the amendments of the Constitution will be rebalanced on a regular basis because the world moves forward. You know, there wasn't the Internet. How does that impact these things? So I do think that we need to constantly have that in view as we go forward, but we have the Supreme Court's case law to rely upon.
And Governor, thank you for being the moderator. Thank you, Larry, and your great crew for putting this on. And thank every person for being here. Colorado is an example, I believe, to the rest of the country on having civil discourse. So thank you for participating, every one of you. Governor, the Second Amendment has not changed. And when it says that we shall not infringe on the right to keep and bear arms, and you find out that if a certain law passes, a firearm that you owned one day is illegal the next day, or features on that firearm are illegal as of the first of the month coming up, to me, that does infringe on keeping that weapon. You had it, it was legal, now it's no longer legal. So I do think we've veered, unfortunately, into some questionable territory and infringing on the U.S. Constitution.
So do you think when we passed laws that said machine guns were illegal, was that an infringement as well?
I wasn't there when that happened.
Well, I'm just saying if you were.
I don't know if they've ever been legal in the first place. But if you're told that a certain appearing type of weapon is legal today but is illegal tomorrow, and you can't keep it, is that an infringement or not? I view that as an infringement.
Fair point.
Governor, I think that the spirit of the Second Amendment is alive and well. And I look at the spirit of the Constitution. We are a free country. We practice the religion we want, and we would fight the government if it infringed on the practice of religion. The same with speech, the same with association. The Second Amendment is the amendment that protects all other amendments in our Bill of Rights and in our Constitution, and I think that spirit is very much alive. I disagree with my friend Senator Morse to an extent. I'm not sure we are moving forward as a country, as a state. I think oftentimes we are moving sideways and sometimes backwards, and it's unfortunate. But I think if we try to infringe on that Second Amendment right, if we try to infringe on any freedom, we are moving backwards.
Okay. Fair. Dave?
The very purpose of writing a constitution is for a government to obey it and for certain things to be off limits to a transient 34-31 majority in a legislative body. You don't rebalance the free exercise of religion because at some time people say, well, we're more against religion or we want to restrict some unpopular religion. The whole point of a constitution is some things are off limits to majorities. At the same time, what the Supreme Court has taught us in the Heller decision is that, like the rest of the Constitution, not every part of the Second Amendment is an absolute. And so when you look at what is protected as arms under the Second Amendment, it's those that are typically owned by law-abiding persons for lawful purposes. One of the bills that passed the House violates that, getting rid of commonly owned accessories for firearms. Likewise, the Second Amendment says that the interest that is elevated above all others, in the words of the Supreme Court, is the right of self-defense, especially in the home. We've seen some pretty harsh attacks in several bills on the right of self-defense. Our Colorado Supreme Court, way back in 1971, in Lakewood versus Pillow, about a law that restricted the transportation of firearms, said, yes, you can have some rules about how firearms are going to be transported, but the broad prohibitions that Lakewood had put in were unconstitutional because they were overbroad. And similarly, while I think you can require background checks on some firearms transactions, the bill that passed the House is unconstitutionally overbroad and reaches far beyond where the government has the legitimate power to go.
Well, Governor, I just really have to disagree because the bills that passed out of the House, it's happening in other states. I mean, there are six other states that have a ban on the high-capacity limit. I mean, there's some that has 10, there's some that have 20. The proposal that passed out of the House restricts it to 15. And when I think about what happened in the Aurora Theater, you know, James Holmes was able to go in that theater with a 100-round magazine full with bullets, and in 90 seconds, he was able to murder and kill far too many people. So I think that we do need to do something to address gun violence, and I think this is just one approach to go about it.
Well, I guess, Representative Fields, this is an example of how one side of this debate frames things exclusively by looking at misuse. And if you're looking at misuse, well, the misuse of handguns in this country is 1,000 times more deadly than magazines of over 15 rounds. Over half the homicides in this country are perpetrated with handguns. And so if you can say, well, here's a crime or two or three crimes in right. which a firearm or a firearm or accessory were used, right. and that's enough for us to ban it, then that's the case for banning all handguns. But the Supreme Court says, no, that's not the right approach. You not only look at what criminals do, you also look at what law-abiding citizens do. And what law-abiding citizens in this country do is they very commonly own handgun magazines up to 20 rounds, rifle magazines up to 30 rounds. The law enforcement organizations I've represented are opposed to magazine bans because they know that law-abiding citizens, certainly for standard magazines of 20 on handguns up to 30 on rifles, own those magazines for precisely the same reason that they're so popular for law enforcement. Not because law enforcement's fighting wars, not because law enforcement's want to go hunting, but because these law enforcement officers choose them as the best tools for the only reason law enforcement carries guns, the lawful defense of self and others.
And see, what I'm talking about is massacres, okay? We've had a total of 34 massacres. And out of the 34 that have taken place in our nation, 28 of them have something in common. And the 28, they all had a high-capacity magazine clip in common. And the only thing that was able to save more lives is whenever that magazine was about ready to be done, then someone was able to tackle that person down and we were able to save lives. We're not talking about handguns. I'm talking about massacres where people are going into our schools, they're going into our churches, they're going into these sacred places, and they're using high-capacity magazines to kill as many people possible. Now, I believe that assault weapons and high-capacity magazines are intended for military war. They're not intended to be a part of our community.
Tom, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yes, Governor. What I would tell you is that during the discussion that we had at the state chief's meeting,
We did not get into the level of detail that the professor is discussing whether or not it's constitutional or not. We feel like that is certainly an issue that will be discussed at a different level. What the police chiefs believe, however, is that by having some type of a ban on magazines, that over time, and it would not happen overnight, and it may take a long time, some of these high-capacity magazines would be taken out of circulation, and it could possibly make it safer for not only for police officers but for the general public. Whether or not it passes constitutional muster or not is really left for others to decide.
May I ask Representative Fields a quick question?
Sure.
In the 34 massacres that you talked about, in 27, 28, maybe even 30, the individuals were on Ritalin, Prozac, or some drug. Would you also ban those drugs because those folks were on those drugs?
Well, this bill that I propose is not addressing medication. You know, we are going to be probably running some legislation that is going to address mental health. And so that is for another discussion. This bill is to restrict the capacity of a high-capacity magazine to 15 in the state of Colorado.
But if the same logic applies where somebody uses a high-capacity magazine to kill multiple people, but that person is using or is on a particular drug, wouldn't you want to ban that drug just as much as you'd want to ban the magazine?
I don't have the data to support legislation to ban that.
I think, actually, we already do. You know, the FDA keeps track of drugs, and when it turns out that their side effects outweigh the benefits, then we do outlaw that drug. We do exactly that. So I think there's no question gun violence is a big problem, and we need a comprehensive solution. And there isn't just one single thing that's going to fix this. It's a combination of things, because Professor Koppel makes a good point. There's an awful lot of violence that's done with handguns. We need to address handguns. That's what background checks are about. Because we sort of, I think, most of us agree that we want to keep guns out of the hands of people that we know they ought not be in the hands of. For example, felons, those that are mentally ill, those that we know would engage in nefarious conduct. How do we figure that out but for a background check? Same thing with the magazines. You know, as the chief suggested, it's not going to solve all of the problems, but it is one part of a comprehensive approach. But I also think, you know, having been a police officer and police chief myself, you know, to suggest that the police are peace officers, absolutely we are, and we keep the peace, but there are many times when we have to run into the danger. We're not defending ourselves. There are many times when we are taking the offense, and that's why the police need the kind of firepower that they need to be able to do what they need to do. But at the same time, that's not necessarily the same kind of firepower that officer needs at home to defend themselves in the very unlikely situation of a home invasion.
Do your officers own magazines over 15 rounds at home, the officers you worked with in the past?
And in the past, no. I mean, we didn't have 20-round magazines. Our magazines carried 14, and there was a 15th in the chamber. We can carry plenty of magazines, and in fact, we do, and we're even taught. You fire a shot or two when you're in a combat situation, as opposed to just a quick shooting, which most of them are, reload right now. I mean, I only cranked off 2 rounds, but I want 15 in this gun, and then I put that magazine back in my pouch because it's still got 12 bullets in it, so I don't want to waste them. But at the same time, I want 15 every second I can have 15. When I'm out shooting, I can't be changing, but when I'm back behind cover and I'm concealed, then yes, let's get as many bullets in there as I can. And then again, I'm only going to be able to do that 3 times because I've only got 3 magazines. But again, I'm being offensive when I'm doing that and not defensive and just repelling an attack, because the police, unfortunately, there are many times when
they
have to go in.
When are the police on the offensive, when they're going in and trying to shoot a bunch of people at once, which is what Representative Fields says the only thing that anybody owns these magazines for? We've got tens of millions of these in the country. And according to Representative Fields, the only reason anybody buys these is because they want to commit mass murder.
And I don't think that's what she thinks, even though I'll let her speak for herself. But, you know, with a magazine that carries 10 or 15 bullets, load it with 10 or 15 bullets. And if you need to go target shooting and you want to crank off 150 rounds and you don't want to have to reload while you're out there, get 10 magazines and fill each with 15 rounds and put a new clip in and do what you need to do. The police go on the offensive every time there's a burglar alarm. Every time I go into a building when the burglar alarm is going off, I've got my gun at the ready because theoretically there are burglars in here, and we're also taught, and I don't want to steal the chief's thunder, but plus one. You know, if I find the burglar, where's the second one? And if I find the second one, where's the third one? So I'm not stopping
until... And what's the difference between a citizen and his home who's got the burglars coming in?
Well, the difference is that We didn't find burglars in those burglary cases, except extremely rarely, and even then we didn't have to shoot them. And the burglars that actually come into people's homes, the last thing they want is an interaction with people. Because they're just trying to take stuff and get the hell out of Dodge.
So then why do the police need 20-round magazines if all the burglars avoid people anyway?
And I'm not arguing that they need 20-round magazines. I did it for many years very successfully with 14 and a 15th in
the chamber.
So
you'd be in favor of a law enforcement ban? What's fair for the goose is fair for the gander. Colorado peace officers are not warriors. So no magazines above 15 for anyone.
I would object.
Be fair.
Yeah, I would object as well.
Tom, would you object to that as well? You know, what we do see, like a lot of the folks up here on this panel, we do see the impacts of what things like Aurora can bring. Yeah, and that was a 100-round magazine, if I understand it right. And when you see something like that, we believe something should be done as well. We looked at the legislation that was proposed, Professor, and to be perfectly honest with you, we thought it made good common sense, and that is why we supported it. We're put in difficult situations all the time, and we see the impacts of that. And so from that perspective, we thought this was good legislation, and that's why we supported it.
I thought maybe, Congressman, we talked a little bit about some of the federal approaches. The President signed 23 executive orders recently around gun violence, addressing gun violence. I thought I'd ask what you think the results of that will be. Will they get some of that legislation through Congress? And then second, this is something you could start with, but I think we'd have several opinions, was the 1994-2004 assault weapon ban. Would you judge that was a success, which was federal?
On the executive orders, I listened to the 23 proposals, and some of them are very legitimate exercises of the presidential prerogative to instruct his executive agencies on how to carry out their business. And that's within his power. They make sense. I have no objection whatsoever. If he wants to encroach on Congress's power to make law, then I do object. He can't make law, but he can do the executive orders within the agencies. So that's how I feel about executive orders in general and those 23 in particular. The legislation that's coming forward, starting in the Senate, Dianne Feinstein has a bill to do the revival of the assault weapon ban. I don't see how that has worked. I mean, the people who obey gun control laws are the good people, the law-abiding citizens, people like we have here today. The bad guys or the mentally ill people are the ones who disregard laws. And if we look at Chicago, Chicago has the highest murder rate in the country. At the same time, they have some of the most strict gun control laws in the country. So if the gun control laws worked, Chicago would be a safer place. I'm just, you know, common sense would tell me that. So I am opposed to Dianne Feinstein's law. I'm not sure it will even make it over to the House, and I don't see it going anywhere in the House should it come over from the Senate.
I applaud President Barack Obama for his leadership in addressing gun violence in our nation. I'm really pleased that our Vice President Biden has commissioned, and he's consulting a lot of different people so that we can most likely come up with some reasonable approach to address this issue for our country. So I think that he's on the right track. You know, it's really frustrating when I hear things like, it's not going to work. It didn't work then. It's not going to work now. I think that kind of attitude does not address the problem. And I think that's why here in the state of Colorado, we have an opportunity to really set the example for the nation by taking an approach that we think that's reasonable, that's responsible. So what has passed out of the House, I think that's a good first step to address gun violence in our nation, in our state.
You know, we have a plan in place. And in fact, since the expiration of the federal assault weapons ban, we have seen murder rates decline in this country. We have seen violence decline. We have seen juvenile violence decline. And the reason is that in the 1980s and the 1990s, we put harsh penalties in place for people who committed violent crime. We built prison cells, federal and state. And the result has been a declining homicide rate. And if we continue with that strategy, we will continue to see a declining homicide rate. We need to deal with the twisted minds who commit these crimes and not the twisted metal that is used in committing the crimes.
The plan, I'm not quite sure what plan you're mentioning, but it's not working. because we have 34 people that are dying a day because of gun violence. 34 people. Since Sandy Hook, there's been over 2,000 people that have been murdered by guns. So the plan that you're speaking about is not working. We need to be doing more.
Governor, I'd say the responsible thing to do is to look at what works and what doesn't and to pass legislation that can work rather than things that have been already proven to fail. When the 1994 ban was enacted, part of the compromises necessary to get it through Congress were that it would have a 10-year sunset and there would be a Department of Justice-mandated study of how well it worked, and then Congress, after the 10 years, could decide whether to renew. Congress chose not to renew in 2004, in part because the interim studies and then the final studies conducted by the Urban Institute, which is a very highly respected left-leaning think tank in Washington, D.C., their final report said this had no beneficial effect. It didn't save lives, and the 10-round magazine ban didn't even seem to affect the number of shots that were fired in various criminal instances as far as they could find. So it had zero beneficial effect. Just today, a very interesting leak has come out of the National Institute of Justice. The NIJ is the research arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. They produced a report on January 4th about various proposals that were being circulated on gun control. What they said on assault weapons was, it's useless, it will do no good. These guns are involved in a very small fraction of crimes. Indeed, rifles in general are quite underrepresented in crime. It said the only way a magazine ban does any good is if you confiscate all the existing magazines. If you can accomplish it, maybe you have a magic magnet, that'll work. But it says the existing supply is so large that unless you're willing to go for confiscation, a ban on future production will do no good.
It's very... it's very difficult, truthfully impossible, to prove a negative. So just like when we talk about Chicago has the highest murder rate in the country, I won't dispute that. And they have the strictest gun control laws, you know, I won't even dispute that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that their murder rate wouldn't be 3 or 4 times what it is, or even 30 or 40% higher than it is, but for those laws. I mean, just because something is after something doesn't mean that it prevented something or that it caused something. So, I mean, there's plenty of statistics here, but there's not much in the way of causation. And the reality is, and I know this from being on the street, there's so much that happens that's just instantaneous crime of passion kind of stuff. And the same with suicides as well as homicides, and the same with accidents. And when these guns are not available, or these magazines are not available because it was a little bit more difficult to get them, there'll still be plenty of them on the street, hopefully in the hands of folks that know how to use them and know how to safeguard them so that they don't fall into hands where they just do damage. But when there's a little bit of a hurdle, who knows how many suicides we're going to prevent? Who knows how many homicides we're going to prevent? Who knows how many accidents we're going to prevent?
Senator, if some of these laws had been in effect, it would have made no difference, unfortunately. Like universal background check. That's one of the proposals floating around in Denver and in Washington. The Aurora shooting, Newtown, and Tucson. Two of those three killers passed background checks. The third one killed his mother and stole her weapons. Background checks were not an issue. So we can propose these laws, and they would not have made a difference. Let me quote Joe Biden. Just last month, he spoke to his Democratic colleagues in the Senate. "Nothing we are going to do is fundamentally going to alter or eliminate the possibility of another mass shooting or guarantee that we will bring gun deaths down." These laws are sometimes, I hate to say this, but people in public office want to be seen as doing something, they care, but what they're proposing will not make a difference and would not have made a difference.
Just so clear, what Vice President Biden said was there's no guarantee. He was not saying there wouldn't be a difference, and I think if he was here, he would take issue.
And Governor, it's just... you know, here we go again, talking about what won't work. And what we do know is that background checks do work. In fact, 80% of the people in Colorado, voters, has suggested and has been polled that they believe that background checks is a good, reasonable approach to save lives and to make our community less dangerous. 80%.
The reason it works is because we currently have background checks right now. When you buy a new gun, you have to perform a background check. And then if you buy a gun at a gun show, you have to perform a background check. So this is going to close the loophole. So if you want to sell a gun privately, then you have to perform a background check. It's my understanding with the CBI, they have, just in 1 month alone, there's been like, I think it was in January, 900, close to 1,000 people were denied access to guns. And the trigger that keeps them from getting a gun is because they've already been identified as someone that's a felon or someone who's been involved in a domestic relationship where there's a restraining order on them or they're mentally ill. We know that background checks can save lives. And so for you to say that that's not going to make a difference when it already does, and what we're trying to do is expand a program that already has been proven that it works. So I think we need to move forward with that.
You're listening to a discussion addressing gun violence, a public forum that was organized by the Counterterrorism Education Learning Lab, or CEL. They gathered a bipartisan group of panelists at the Sewell Ballroom in Denver last Tuesday to debate what the response should be to recent mass shootings in places such as Aurora and Newtown, Connecticut. The panelists that you'll hear are U.S. Representative Doug Lamborn, Weld County District Attorney Ken Buck, Independence Institute Research Director David Koppel, Broomfield Police Chief Tom DeLand, State Representative Rhonda Fields, and State Senate President John Morse. As we return to the discussion, Governor John Hickenlooper addresses the next question to David Koppel.
We are spending a lot of time talking about guns, and we are going to come back to guns, but I thought it would be worth not just treating the issue completely in a silo and begin to talk a little bit about mental health. And do you have suggestions and ideas of how we could address issues around mental health when we're discussing gun violence?
Sure. The real thread that runs through mass murder in this country is not the particular type of gun or magazine. It's mental illness. The age of onset for schizophrenia is so frequently late teens, early 20s for young males. This is overwhelmingly the perpetrators of these crimes, and we see so often they were people who are identified by their community as dangerously mentally ill. The Tucson murderer got kicked out of Pima Community College because he was dangerously mentally ill, and the administration recognized that, and then there was no follow-up. You kick him out of the college, but you keep him on the streets. That's a recipe for what happened. We've seen that Adam Lanza, the Connecticut murderer, his mother was working to have him institutionalized, but it hadn't happened, and she apparently quite recklessly left her firearms available to him. We know about the Aurora murderer and how his psychiatrist actually broke psychiatric confidentiality to identify him as a danger to the CU threat crisis team because he was an imminent, violent danger. Putting aside these mass crimes, which attract so much attention, there's so much crime perpetrated by that very small subset of mentally ill people who are, as a whole, are not more dangerous than anyone else. But that small subset of the violently mentally ill does commit a lot of crimes. One-third of the variation state to state in homicide rates is due to the weakest states versus the stronger states in their involuntary civil commitment laws. One-sixth of the people in prison in the United States for homicide right now in state prisons are mentally ill. This is something that is long overdue for us to start addressing. You know, why do we have so many more of these crimes now than we did in 1962? You could be 15 years old, or 1964, you could walk into a hardware store and buy an AR-15 rifle with whatever magazines you wanted, no questions asked in most of this country. And we didn't have these kinds of crimes. And the difference is we had institutionalization then in an effective way. We don't have it now. We need to, as we reform the system, make absolutely sure to protect due process better than we did in the 50s and the 60s, but with proper due process protections. That's absolutely essential for public safety in general and reducing mass murders.
Ken, you want to add to that?
I think we agree on an awful lot in what you just said, and I truly hope that we are going to fund mental illness a lot better than we have. I mean, I've been working at that for 6 years, and I'm happy to have this newfound support. I just hope that it's real and that we're actually going to put some resources behind it. But the other thing that we have to recognize is the rest of the world is pretty much as mentally ill as we are. And they don't have the same levels of gun violence that we have, because we do make it so easy to get guns. And so we've got to address this in both ways, not just in mental illness and not just in making sure that we do everything we can to make sure people don't get guns that shouldn't have them.
But I think we just need to be very careful, because everyone who has a mental illness doesn't mean that they're going to commit murder. And so I think it's real important that we don't demonize people who have mental illness, because I think it's 1 in 4 that can have a mental illness. So that's a lot of folks. And people that work with people who have mental illness are really concerned about what we're doing as it relates to trying to associate these mass murders with mental illness.
I appreciate you saying that. Before I get 100 emails from mental health advocates tomorrow, I'd like to clear up what I was saying earlier. There are only a small, small fraction
right.
of folks with mental health problems that commit these massacres or killings.
Right.
It's also a small, small fraction of people that own magazines over 20 rounds that commit any kind of crime. And so, in fact, I would suggest that that number is even smaller. And so I think my point earlier was not that we should do something drastic on the mental health side, but rather that there's a correlation there, and that it is clear to me that solving the magazine issue or the background check issue is going to have a very small effect on crime, when in fact what we've been doing, where we are hammering defendants and giving them long jail sentences for being violent, is in fact having a positive impact.
And while we're on that, I think that, because it is a question that gets asked repeatedly, why is the United States so much more violent? People talk about the prevalence of violence in our cinema, on TV, in videos. Do you all think that that's an issue, that these cultural factors contribute to gun violence? If so, how should we think about addressing it?
I think the president just commissioned a study so that he could have the Department of Disease look at this whole issue as it relates to media and violence, because I think that our kids are bombarded a lot with negative images on music and games and movies, and I think that does influence, but that's just my view, and I would like to see some scientific evidence-based research to kind of back that up and to come up with some proposals that might work, but we have to wait to see the outcome.
I can tell you that certain of the game companies have done a lot of that research, and they don't think there is a close correlation. So
I'm going to agree with Rhonda, and this is something I think we can fully agree on. We do need more research. We do need to look very closely at this. I find it ironic that some of the same entertainment companies, video games, movies, and they say that this doesn't influence young people and so on. But then they turn around and sell advertising, and they say it does influence your buying habits. So I find that ironic.
Governor, I guess I would question the premise of the question. England, one of those places that people look to and say, oh, look, they've got laws, one after the other, designed to deter law-abiding citizens from owning guns. Their total violent crime rate is higher than the United States. Now, if you go ask Piers Morgan, he'll give you a statistic about gun homicides or gun suicides, and that's true. You know, if you outlaw lawnmowers, you'll have fewer lawnmower accidents than countries that permit them. But if you look at their homicide rate, fluctuates between 1 and 2. Our homicide rate is in the 4s. Their assault rate is massively higher than ours for serious assaults. Their burglary rate is massively higher than ours in England than in the United States. So England is a more dangerously violent country than the United States. And one reason, one reason is the English government has destroyed the culture of self-defense in that country.
Governor, if I can go back to an earlier point, one of the things that's interesting, this past summer, the State Chiefs Association had one of the leading police psychologists in this part of the country talk to us about the very issue that you asked about. That is whether or not our young people have become desensitized to violence. And it was his opinion that they certainly have. And I think, to answer your question more directly, based on what the Chiefs Association has been told and kind of our viewpoint, is that there has been a significant desensitization of violence by our young people. And I think that does have an impact on what's going on.
You're saying that that's a result of the media?
The things that were mentioned primarily were things like gaming, the entertainment industry, and things like that. And the example that was given is if you take a look at a movie that was kind of scary back in the 70s when we were younger, and you look at that same movie today, it would probably make you laugh, not make you afraid.
Interesting point. Just to get back to the statistics about Great Britain, you can mix statistics because Great Britain also has significantly higher beer consumption, which could lead to some of those assaults.
No, they have a much. You're right. They have a much more irresponsible attitude about it.
So the House, as we touched on this earlier, the House recently sent 4 gun safety bills to the Senate for consideration. I thought it'd be good to let each of you, or you can start with how you think these bills are going to impact gun violence, and then we can hear a point and counterpoint.
You know, I think that they will impact gun violence because background checks, I believe, is going to make our community less dangerous and it's going to save lives. I believe if you reduce the number of bullets in a magazine to 15, I think that's going to save lives. I think that when you look about the concealed carry on our college campus, that's going to save lives. We're going to see some more bills that's going to address mental health as a duty to warn and to notify, so that's a trigger for CBI checks. So I think that all of these things are just holistic approach to address gun violence in our community. This is a serious, complicated issue. So I don't think it's going to be like one approach that's going to fix everything. But I think that what we're doing are just reasonable approaches to address gun violence.
Ken, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think background checks is just absolutely insane. First of all, it's not universal. Criminals don't buy guns at gun stores. They steal guns, they trade them for drugs.
Actually, just for the record, just more fact-based, of the background checks that were people... We've caught, I can't remember how many, I think there were 46 felons that were trying to buy a gun and got a background check. Criminals are often stupid. Just so
okay.
So it's, there is some factual basis for that does catch, it maybe doesn't catch all the crooks, but it catches the dumb ones.
Okay.
It catches
the... I'll stipulate that there are dumb criminals.
I'll stipulate.
But I will also ask my friends here in law enforcement to, you know, truthfully answer this question. The guns that we have traced in murders that are used by gangbangers and drug dealers are typically stolen weapons. They are traded in the criminal underground. These folks are not going to get caught, typically, the smart ones, the above-average intelligence ones, aren't going to get caught in a background check, but they will find a way to get a gun and commit a crime. And that's where the serious gun violence in this crime, we can look at massacres and talk about mental health and other things. These are criminal defendants that are part of gangs that shoot people because they have gang pressures on them and financial incentives. And those guns are not guns that are being purchased at gun stores. And so this universal background check is a misnomer. It's not universal. It only is going to stop law-abiding citizens or slow down law-abiding citizens from getting a gun.
Mr. D, I would agree with a lot of what you said. In fact, and another way that oftentimes criminals obtain guns is by having somebody else purchase it for them and then hand it off to them. From the position of the state chiefs, the reason why the state chiefs supported the background checks, we believe that it makes sense to try and keep guns to whatever level we can out of the hands of people who should not have them. And if the universal background check helps do that, we believe it's a good move. And we fully realize that it's not going to keep guns out of the hands of the smart criminals or a lot of people. But it is one step towards keeping some of the guns out of the hands of some of the people that should not have them. And that's why we supported it.
David had his hand up first.
I echo the chief's position that you want to have good laws to try to do the best you can at keeping guns out of the wrong hands. And at the same time, a responsible and balanced approach also recognizes that guns in the right hands are important for public safety. The universal check bill, as it was passed the House, is not balanced because it has in many provisions things that keep guns out of the right hands. Let me give you just 2 quick examples, and there are a lot more. If you are a Boy Scout leader and you have the troop over to your home to teach them gun safety. You're not talking about target shooting. Parents don't want to do that. But you want to have them handle one of your guns just like one at a time. It's unloaded, no ammunition in the room. That's prohibited. It's illegal for me as a safety instructor to do that with any student. without putting those students through a background check. And there are many, many other situations on top of that, but let me mention the most crucial one. Someone who needs a firearm for immediate self-defense. There's a provision in there that seems to address that, but it says you can give the gun to somebody for immediate self-defense if you do it in that person's home, and it's under the same circumstances. It copies this from the law where you'd be justified to shoot someone. So a woman calls and says, Dave, there's this stalker who's been, like, after me. He keeps calling me and calling me and calling me. Can I borrow one of your guns and just have it at my house to protect myself and my children for the next several days? The answer is, she just came by my house. No, I can't give her the gun in my house. I've got to go over to her house to do it. I don't see what the point of that is. And secondly, if I'm obeying the law, I can only give her the gun if she is in imminent danger of death or serious bodily injury. That's the standard under the law at which you can shoot somebody. Well, she's not at the standard where if she sees this guy on the street, she can go shoot him, but he's a dangerous threat. You ought to be able to give a gun to a person who is in reasonable apprehension of danger rather than you can only get a gun in an emergency if you're at the same standard as of which you could shoot somebody. That's just wrong. It doesn't make common sense. So
I have to completely disagree with your reading of the bill with respect to the Boy Scouts. I don't think there's anything in that bill that comes anywhere close to what you're talking about, although, you know, I have the bill with me, and we can certainly in the back room go through it, and you can show me where you're right and I'm wrong, but I can assure you that was certainly not the intent. Yeah. In terms of the woman that you're trying
like,
to...
Sounds like that would be changed in the Senate.
It was brought up on the floor of the House repeatedly.
There was a lot brought up on the floor of the House that was utter nonsense.
This was an issue that was identified on the floor, and people didn't do anything about it.
And then with respect to the woman that's being stalked and whatnot, I mean, it seems to me, certainly you could go over to her house with your gun and protect her for the time being because there's an imminent threat. But if she needs a gun for the next week or 2 weeks, run through the background check because you probably actually don't know as much about her as perhaps you think. And let's just make sure because, again, if we've got time to run through a background check. Let's run through a background check, and then you can have that gun because you are... A law-abiding citizen that's entitled to the gun.
You can't go to a gun store on a Saturday night for the background check, and it takes 3 days anyway, which is illegal in violation of the Colorado statute setting up the background checks. So not every woman who's a victim of a stalker has some nice guy who's going to come live with her for 3 days while we wait for the background check to get done.
But just in the spirit of, you know, full debate here, we also don't have a plethora of those murders on the front page of the Denver Post. I mean, he says we do, you know, we call the police and we get extra patrol checks and we do what we need to do to talk to folks to make sure, you know, let's tone this down so that you don't come and do something to her that you have no business doing.
We do have some time. I want to make sure the audience, I want to thank them for sending in some questions and wanted to ask a few questions that the audience suggested. The first one that was sent in, gun control advocates often state that gun owners are more likely to be shot by their own weapons rather than use them successfully to defend themselves or others. What do you think about this?
It's nonsense.
It
includes the statistic of suicide in that if you take suicides out, that statistic changes dramatically.
Okay.
I would say what I heard on the floor of the House the past few days says there's a lot of people who think that. Representative Salazar, Representative Levy, were very much making the point that self-defense just doesn't work. People aren't capable of doing it. Don't have a gun. You'll make a mistake. You'll shoot the wrong person. Even if that argument were true, which it's not statistically, as Mr. Buck points out, even if it were, the Second Amendment puts that off limits. It says people have a right. And similarly, the First Amendment, freedom of speech and freedom of the press, says, fine, come in with whatever studies you have about video games and Quentin Tarantino movies, and there's actually quite a lot, and a lot of them are harmful, according to some of the studies. But the First Amendment says you can't have government censorship like that. And if you think we need censorship so much, or if you think we need to prohibit people from being able to bear arms for self-defense, or we should have try to reduce the number of guns in society, amend the Constitution. And if you're not willing to get the supermajority that can amend the Constitution, then obey the Constitution.
So the study that I've seen out of Pennsylvania on this is that assault victims that try to defend themselves with guns are 4.5 times more likely to get shot and over 4 times more likely to be killed in the process. And again, I can tell you, in the police world, the vests that we wear are rated to stop our own handgun, because every fight we get into is a gunfight, even though we don't get to use the gun in every fight. So the reality is, even police officers have to worry about exactly this problem. And police officers, unfortunately, die in the hundreds every year, even though they have plenty of firepower at their disposal. And too much of the time, you know, the gun is still holstered, and sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it's used directly against them. So I think, you know, we know where there are more guns, there are, you know, 11 times more suicides, 7 times more homicides, 4 times more accidents. I mean, even as you talked about Britain earlier, you know, we have a 4% homicide rate, they have a 2%. And about half our homicides, a little bit more, are done with guns. So other than that, we're like just as violent as everybody else, and everybody else is just as violent as we are.
Clearly, with all this additional gun ownership, we have fallen down in terms of the educational component. So the question is, how do we expand our educational awareness of the responsibilities that come with gun ownership?
Chief? I think the chiefs believe that public education when it comes to firearms is very important and will continue to be, just like anything else that somebody operates.
Yeah, I just think that when I think about gun safety, I think that's so very important that if you do have a gun, I believe it should be secured. It should be out of the way so that a child or a person doesn't get access to a gun and does something to harm himself or others. So I think that that's an opportunity for us to maybe look at regulations or pass some legislation that would increase gun safety moving forward.
Ouch. The more secure we have it, the more out of the way we have it, the more we can't use it to protect ourselves, which is the very reason that we have a gun.
Just keep it out on the table so someone could just, you know.
No, I don't want to have it out on the table.
No, I think there needs to be some responsibility. I think that, you know, if you have a gun, it needs to be secured. It needs to be out of the way.
And would you be in favor, for example, of gun safety classes in schools to make sure that we have millions of guns?
You know, I don't believe that our schools should be set up for an environment to teach kids gun safety. I think if that is something that the parents want to do, then they should do that outside of the classroom and the school environment.
Do you think the same about sex education, by the way?
Yeah, I knew that was coming.
That was low. I tell you, that was a low blow.
Next question from the audience. I would be happy to pay a specific tax surcharge to fund our correction system to enable them to keep violent offenders incarcerated for the full term of their sentence rather than releasing them due to overcrowding. What is the opinion of the panel? Just for the record, that's no longer. We don't have overcrowding. We're not releasing people because of overcrowding. We're having a significant decline in our population.
And I was going to ask the district attorney, because he probably knows off the top of his head, but I think, you know, when you're convicted of a violent felony, and that's defined in statute, you have to serve 75% of your sentence as it is now before you're eligible for parole. Isn't that, am I right?
Depending on whether it's a crime of violence or
right.
not, yes.
So it could be more if it's a crime of violence? Does
no,
it go
it's up?
Up
to 75%.
Okay.
And then you're faced with a parole board, so you may not get out at 75%.
Right. And even if you do get out after 100%, you're still on parole for 5 years. So
in some cases.
Right. So I actually think we're sort of doing a good chunk of what they're suggesting right there anyway. And again, I think where the misperception may be is actually at the county level, where there are some county jails with misdemeanants and DUIs and things like that that are still having to say, we've got to let some people go, but they're not people convicted or even charged with violent crimes. I mean, I think we probably pretty much agree on that.
Actually, because of the successful strategies that were put in place in the 1990s, the governor announced recently that we are going to close 40 juvenile beds in the state because we don't have the demand for those beds. We have less juvenile violent crime to such a degree now that we can handle it with less resources.
Could early education play a larger role in preventing gun violence? Are there programs or effective educational classes that can be offered in our schools, perhaps from other states or other cities, to help prevent violence from continuing to impact our community?
Accidents are the place we've made the most progress as a country. So there are programs like the Eddie Eagle Gun Safety Program, mm-hmm. like Smokey the Bear. If you see a gun, stop, don't touch, leave the area, tell an adult. I think that's a contributor to the continuing decline in childhood gun accidents, and it would be a fine idea if every public school and independent school in Colorado taught that. But I think what your question gets at is more on intentional violence. Early childhood intervention is one of the best things to reduce crime 15 or 20 years later, but you have to spend a lot of money doing it. The programs that work, like the Syracuse Youth Development Program, the other studies, it's not a matter of, I mean, Head Start that makes people feel good. It has some short-term educational gains. But the things that take the people who are most at risk, you know, very troubled, dysfunctional homes, serious learning deficits, the things that turn those around are things like the Perry Preschool Experiment. And it means you're spending on a highly at-risk 3- and 4- and 5-year-old the equivalent of 2 years' tuition at the most expensive private school in the state, and supplementing that with visiting nurse programs and other things. Those things pay for themselves in the long run just in reduced criminal justice costs. But it's hard to get a legislature to spend money now for saving lives and money 20 years from now.
This could be the news coming out that Independence Institute backs a tax increase for early childhood education.
No, we just want to cut corporate welfare to pay for it.
Oh, right. Just so you hear that, we want to cut corporate welfare in order to pay for it.
Yes.
Okay. I didn't want to get either of us in trouble.
Yeah.
I know you didn't pay to come here to watch John Morse and David Koppel agree, but but on this point, we do agree. And what's interesting is right now, I think, especially in the House, the gun debate has taken all of the oxygen out of the room. But we are actually looking at restructuring the way we do school finance, because we agree that, you know, we have half-day kindergarten for way too few of our school districts throughout the state, and that has tremendous impacts all the way through. And it may, criminal justice may pay for it all by itself, the savings in that, but it also pays for itself in terms of these people have better opportunities, they make more money, they need Medicaid less, all those kinds of things. And so we will be working on trying to do just this, and that will be, you know, the next controversy that the chief certainly won't be here to argue about that. But, you know, we've got other big issues to try to fix to do exactly some of those things, and there's going to be plenty of debate around those because they do cost money, and we have to figure out how are we going to pay for those things.
I trust the chiefs of police agree with that. I want to make sure we end on a
kumbaya.
Kumbaya.
We're with you, Governor.
You've been listening to a discussion addressing gun violence, a forum that was organized and hosted by the Counterterrorism Education Learning Lab, or CEL. The event took place at the Sewell Ballroom in the Denver Performing Arts Center last Tuesday. We edited the discussion to fit the time constraints of our program. You can find links to more information about the event and the panel participants and hear the entire unedited conversation on our website at cpr.org. I'm Dave Fender, and this is Showcase on Colorado Public Radio.